It's our own, our very own, Felicity Shoulders. Science fiction writer, storyteller, musician, and climate resilience activist. Felicity comes to us today on short notice. You'll notice her name is not in your order of service, but she is here, and she's ready to speak to us about considering and paying attention to permaculture and climate. Dear Felicity, come up, please.
Our reading today is by Mary Oliver. The Summer Day. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean. The one who has flung herself out of the grass, the one who is eating sugar out of my hand, who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down, who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention and how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I have been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? Attention isn't action. We hear that all the time from those concerned with the rise of slacktivism or the addictive properties of the 24-hour news cycle. Paying attention is not sufficient to make things better, but as a way of being present, as a first step to learning, it is so necessary. As some of you know, I've become very interested in gardening to fight climate change, to increase the life in soil, and therefore the actively cycling carbon sequestered in it, to grow food closer to home, where no fuel need be burned to bring it to me, and more. Today, I was hoping to bring my high school friend who ignited this interest for me to speak at WWF. He has devoted his life and training to mitigating climate change, and he is starting a nonprofit, Build Soil, centering those efforts. He was unable to attend for various reasons, including but not limited to the unexpected delivery many months early of 8,000 chestnuts all at once. So instead, I'd like to talk to you about what I've learned entering on this project of enriching the patch of earth I live on, learning about permaculture techniques, and taking my first toddling steps toward becoming a part-time backyard farmer. Permaculture is the science and pursuit of permanent agriculture, an attempt to work with local ecosystems in order to make human food sustainably. Done well, a permaculture food garden should be easy to maintain because the living things in and around it aren't being suppressed or pushed far out of their natural life cycles. If you catch rainwater high up, you can let it flow downhill when it's time to irrigate instead of working against gravity. By the same principles, working with nature instead of against it is easier for us and better for living systems. Can I get my first slide? This is all expressed in the permaculture principles, which were developed by David Holmgren. Permaculture has even more principles than Unitarian Universalism. White Australians David Holmgren and Bill Mollison coined the term permaculture in the 1970s, but they took inspiration from the natural or do-nothing farming techniques of Japanese agricultural scientist Masanobu Fukuoka and from indigenous agriculture methods all over the world. Many of the techniques and food ways modern permaculture embraces are indigenous wisdom from the Americas. The biochar practices that created the fertile black terra preta soils in the Amazon, and the famous Three Sisters system of companion planting, beans, corn, and squash, learned from the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, which I'm sure many of us have actually used ourselves. The central ethics of permaculture are earth care, people care, and fair share. Earth care, we should care for the natural systems that support all life. Sounds familiar. People care, we should help sustain ourselves, our families, and our communities. Fair share, we should share our surplus and avoid waste whenever possible. Today I want to talk about one of permaculture's principles, the first one, observe and interact. It's at 1 o'clock up here. Can I get my second slide? This is just a close-up on the principles so that they're more clearly labeled. This is the first principle for a reason. Everything else depends on approaching the land with curiosity. What is happening outside our doorsteps? What is trying to grow? What eats in our yards or on our balconies? What is living there or dying? We can't intervene in these systems well until we see them, and we can't see them without time, patience, and attention. I am very new to learning about permaculture and implementing it in my own garden, but here are some of the things I've seen. Chives, planted by the previous owner, sprouting up everywhere in the side yard and the front yard, their smell sharp and clean. Horsetails, survivors from the Jurassic, but thriving in my yard, in shade or sun, and even coiling pale and subterranean as earthworms under the plastic weed barrier my predecessor buried. The Chattertons, a family of scrub jays I began befriending soon after we moved in, hold sway over the rose garden and the backyard, especially when they have eggs in their nest in the neighbor's arborvitae. They are chary, though, of crossing the bullying neighborhood crow gang, who mostly stick to the front yard and arrive after the early rising robins clock out. I cannot blame the Chattertons for ceding territory and dominance to these fellow corvids. A group of jays is a scold, while a group of crows is a murder. Slugs love to eat the leaves of bush beans, but they don't seem to go after the beans. In spite of the patrols of our neighbor's outdoor cats and a few streetwise strays, small bunnies occasionally appear in our yard or leave their droppings to enrich the soil. Hummingbirds do, against common wisdom, stay still for quite a while, often perched among the thorny twigs of our wild rose. Some of my observations are less general, singular moments that feel like rewards for the attention I've given. Dark-eyed juncos leaping and clicking around each other in a competitive springtime dance. One of the Chattertons burying something, about the size and shape of a peanut, in the back lawn after first carefully looking around. Studies of western scrub jays, one of the two species of birds with the largest demonstrable memories, show they can hide and remember thousands of food caches, including whether the items that they hid was perishable or not. The studies also show that jays are careful of who might be watching them hide food and engage in more precautions around food caching if they themselves have stolen other jays' food in the past. A classic case of projection. This jay looked around carefully, but then flew away with his scold to sit in a tree together. The pirate who appeared did not seem to have observed the hiding. It was a squirrel following his nose toward the cache site. As the Chattertons' family friend, I admit I did scare the squirrel off a few times before I had to go inside and leave it in possession. I often hear the angry chirping of hummingbirds, sparring over flowering bushes in summer, and one evening I saw a hummingbird dogfight. The entire yard was the field of these ferocious thimblefuls' encounter, and they used it all, chasing and buzzing each other, evading with amazing loop-de-loops, disengaging only to ambush each other again by speeding in over our house at what I assume were proportionally fighter jet speeds. I could barely stand to blink. I stood completely rapt. Finally, when one of the fighters was breathing hard in the shelter of that wild rose and the other rebuilding his strength at a trumpet vine flower, I texted my spouse what I'd been seeing. Video or it didn't happen, he joked. But some things are impossible to capture unless your boss's name is Attenborough. You can only catch them, hold them, by being present, really present, in the moment they're happening. Sometimes observing is all we have to do to heal the land we live on. Isabella Tree wrote a book about rewilding her farm in West Sussex, England. She was worried that letting nature take back the land wasn't working when, several years in, it was overrun by thistles. Cursed thistle, she calls the plant, a 3-foot-tall weed that spreads rapidly through tap roots and crowds out everything else. Then one Sunday, she saw painted lady butterflies from her window. She writes, "Outside, thousands upon thousands of them, migrating to the UK from Morocco, had descended on the swaths of creeping thistle to lay their eggs. As we approached, our dogs ran into the prickly cover, sending up puffs of orange and brown wings like autumn leaves. We walked for half an hour that morning, parting curtains of butterflies. A few weeks later, spiky black caterpillars were swarming over the thistles, spinning silken webs like tents. The whole area took on the appearance of a chaotic army encampment. By autumn, the caterpillars had wolfed down the leaves, pupated and flown away, leaving our thistle fields in tatters. The following year, our 60 acres of creeping thistle had vanished entirely." Nature is constantly seething, striving, balancing, and rebalancing in ways no amount of quiet observation will ever fully unlock. But we can sit quietly and pay attention. We can observe. And what about interact? The permaculture principle is observe and interact. We learn more about the ecosystems in our neighborhoods when we give them a little jiggle and see what happens. I also like to think of this as observe and make mistakes. I have made many mistakes. I have observed from my interactions that the easiest method for planting buckwheat seeds did not get me a cover crop of fast-growing plants to use as living mulch to prevent erosion and later to uproot and use as biomass to enrich my soil. Instead, it provided a feast for the song sparrows that live in the lilac tree and the spotted towhees that flit by for a visit now and then. Permaculture designers talk about relative location as part of Principle 8, planting your veggies close to your door where it's convenient to tend them. Integrate, don't segregate, is the principle. When I learned that a huckleberry bush planted out of sight in the side yard is a huckleberry bush I never water, I definitely decided to start paying more attention to Principle 8. I'm sorry, little huckleberry. I learned that aphids and flea beetles love Brussels sprouts as much as I do. That corn pollen washes right off in a rain shower, leaving you very little to hand pollinate with if you didn't protect the corn's tassels ahead of time. But I've also learned that my spouse likes to eat green beans fresh from the bush and that the bushes give happily all summer long. I've learned that the only thing that is easier for me to grow than squash is potatoes. And I made mistakes with them. In a hurry to get my sprouted taters salvaged from a friend's kitchen into the ground before leaving town one day, I cut them all up and planted them in the same day, if not the same hour. You have to let the pieces dry first, an experienced friend chastened me. They'll just rot in the ground. Rot? Those trash potatoes? They came up rich green and crinkle-leafed, eager for sun. I learned potato plants grow fast. I learned potato plants get big. I learned potato blossoms smell faintly sweet, and that purple potatoes grow lavender flowers where yellow potatoes grow white. I learned there is nothing like the feeling of reaching into the dirt under a yellowed, fallen potato stalk and pulling out an amethyst nugget the size of my fist. This month, we've learned that attention is respect, that paying attention takes us out of ourselves and helps us see where there is pressing need. It's true for people, and it's true for nature. I learned at General Assembly this year that some permaculture practitioners are adding a fourth ethic after people care, earth care, and fair share, transition aware. In order to sustain ourselves and help nature cope with the sudden changes that are occurring, we first need to know our backyards. The 12th principle is respond to change. You'll note that on this diagram, the 12th principle comes right before the first principle. Change is another thing for us to observe and learn from. With these principles and the wisdom we can learn and share with each other, we can make diverse, resilient systems and respond when climate change makes new conditions. Permaculture teaches us to work with succession, to learn how species follow each other as a forest expands into a woodland, or when a tree dies and creates new conditions on the ground where it stood. We are in an age of succession, and we need to see where we are to determine where we're going. Even though it's cold today, even though it's wet, I urge you to take a moment to be silent and watchful outside. Breathe in that cold air, smell the plant material rotting into rich humus, and the evergreen needles wafting their resinous scent. Listen to the birds. And if you have a yard and more than that moment, I urge you to throw some more leaves on your compost pile or start planning which vegetables to plant in your own climate victory garden. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. We do have some time for questions and answers, and I know that Felicity is eager to respond. So let's pass a microphone. Put your hand up if you've got something you'd like to ask or say.
Good morning.
Morning.
So when we last spoke, you and I, we talked about chestnut trees. And
yes.
So I, since you mentioned 8,000 chestnuts, I wondered if you could share an update on that and how that is being used with your efforts.
Sure. So my friend who was going to speak, Jordan Fink, is a landscape designer by training. And I forgot what his master's is in. But he has an idea that, well, his main thrust of his efforts, as the name of his nonprofit indicates, is build soil, is that we should be getting more layers of living soil with healthy bacteria and worms and ecosystems. But he's also really into people growing food where they are. And so he's interested in doing tree planting efforts that plant trees that produce food for people in urban and suburban areas. So he is trying to get people distributed, you know, from people that he's met through his Twitter account, which he's up to, I think, 10,000 followers now, to plant chestnut trees all over the world where chestnut trees are ecologically appropriate. And that's a lot of the temperate zone. Chestnuts are in the beech family, and beech trees work well with grasslands. Individual beech oak chestnuts are a good neighbor to grasses and the kind of animals that live in them. We used to have a very well-developed chestnut population in America before they died back in the blight. Which happened around the same time as World War I. And actually, a lot of the trees that died during the blight were killed in order to stop the spread of the blight. There is no chestnut blight in Europe, nor in Asia. So there they have diverse, thriving populations of chestnut trees that are not subject to the blight. And in some cases, certainly in Europe, there's actually also a chestnut culture in Asia, but I don't know as much about it, have been feeding people for thousands of years. There are chestnut trees in Italy that science has been unable to determine the age of because the wood has grown so densely that they have been unable to draw a needle core from it. They can't get all the way in to count the rings. So possibly 6,000-year-old chestnut trees? We're not sure. But they continue to give. Unlike domesticated apples, where the apples stop being good at some point, if you have a 6,000-year-old chestnut tree, it is still giving you an amazing amount of chestnuts. So anyway, I digress. Jordan is urging people to plant edible trees where they are. Mesquite in the Southwest and in Southern California, chestnut trees in a lot of other places, and I'm part of the Portland chapter that's trying to plant about a bunch of chestnut trees. And we have a donor that gave Jordan the funds to buy the first 8,000 chestnuts and set up his nonprofit. So that's what he's working on right now, is getting all his papers filed and everything. We have people who have experience with the City of Portland's bureaucracy, trying to negotiate with the City of Portland to see if we can get them to waive the street trees fees, so that if people want to plant a chestnut in the next to the road, they would not have to pay the, I think it's $100 to plant a street tree and register a street tree. So that's what we're doing. We have people working on places where we're going to be able to put them, hopefully talking to the Park Service to see whether they'd be interested in getting chestnut groves going. We're also trying to figure out how to reach out to the Chinese American community, because the chestnuts that there are already in Portland parks, there are older Chinese American people that already harvest from them every year. So we want to make sure that we aren't stepping on anybody else's traditional food ways, and that we're creating more bounty to share instead of not taking care of who is already interested in this stuff. So I will have, come springtime, if you're interested, I will be growing seedlings, but I don't have anywhere to plant them permanently. So we may have chestnut coming in at Woof. I know that Suzanne has indicated there might be some room. And you want to plant them in pairs, actually, or else they won't give nuts. And for anyone who's ever had a chestnut or a horse chestnuts make just as much mess, but you can't eat them. So an unpollinated chestnut makes just as much mess as a pollinated chestnut. And in fact, if you have a pollinated chestnut, then if you don't catch those nuts, then the squirrels will take them away. So they're a little more self-cleaning than the unpollinated kind.
I realize that places like San Francisco and parts of France that are really densely populated have made it illegal to plant fruit trees, especially on a place that has a sidewalk, for fear of, you know, if things aren't cleaned up because of the urbanization, you know, there aren't as many squirrels or trash pandas or whatnot to take everything away, right, that it becomes a safety issue. So is there a reason why chestnuts were chosen? Is that like a more safe a tree to live around for people who are walking or pedestrians?
No. They do drop a bunch of stuff, although actually, in case you're ever trying to tell the difference between horse chestnuts and chestnuts, the chestnut burrs are actually a little softer than horse chestnuts, and we have horse chestnuts all over Portland, which is one, you know, when people say, but they're messy. Well, we're living with completely useless messy trees already. Jordan is committed to working with folks that will go and collectively harvest. So the idea is that we're not just planting these trees and forgetting about them. If they're on your own land and you want to have the nuts, that's great. But if you're letting people plant them and you're not interested in having the nuts, then there will be a chestnut collective, and we're talking about whether we want to try to make a chestnut fair for collective processing, which is what they do in Italy, or what have you. So they're not going to be forgotten. And the reason that it shows chestnuts, as well as the fact that they're part of an ecosystem that has been really widespread in America and has kind of died back due to this blight, is also that they produce a lot of food, they grow fast, and it's more of a grain equivalent nutritionally. I'm not a nutritionist. I don't completely understand this, but they're not tree nuts. And they produce a grain equivalent food instead of just a protein like a normal nut. And fewer people are allergic to them.
Thank you for that talk.
Okay. Last question.
Last question. Mm-hmm. This is more of a comment. I was staring at BoobTube last night, and there was a piece on the show about somewhere on the east side of our country, there are single-family residences. They, historically, apparently they were saying, we've built single-family residences. And what's happening in those areas is the cost of living and the cost of renting or buying is going way up, which leaves low-income people out.
Mm-hmm.
They are solving that, or trying to solve that problem by rezoning,
mm-hmm.
getting rid of the single-family homes and yards, and I presume room to grow things in the backyard for multiple family units, apartments, to get the cost of renting or buying down, but it's also getting rid of those homes and spaces to plant.
It's a real problem, and we have to balance these things because obviously we have a housing crisis on the West Coast, and we need to increase density, and all of us need to be willing to see more dense housing go into our neighborhoods and welcome that. But we also don't want to lose our green spaces. It's true. I know that near the Methodist Church, off of Barber, there's that community garden, which they're threatening to sell so that they have room to put low-income housing in for the Barber TriMet development. My response to that is, don't you think the low-income people could really benefit from having a community garden? Couldn't you build your housing around that plot of land? So it is a real problem, and we know that climate change is affecting that the rise in temperature affects places that don't have green spaces more. And in fact, recent studies have shown that redlined areas of American cities, which certainly include the redlined areas of Portland, which were very, very dense because the areas where African Americans were confined by the redlining system were not large enough. And so they are some of the densest areas in the city because they were so dense. To this day, they have less green space, and redlined areas of cities are actually experiencing a greater temperature increase than the other areas of the city. So it's a huge question, and we need to think about how we design all of our public spaces so that we aren't just packing humans in on top of each other, but considering humans as part of ecosystems.
Thank you.